Hello, welcome to the Pyramid Podcast, where three lads discuss all things English football pyramid. On today's episode, Erik ten Hag has left Man United, with Sporting Lisbon manager Ruben Amorim set to take over at Old Trafford. Until then, it's Van Nistelrooy in charge and Ruud's Reds get off to a winning start. Has Pep Guardiola lost his love for the Carabao Cup after defeat at Spurs? We'll have a preview of the big Premier League games at the weekend, including Arsenal's trip to Newcastle. We'll have a roundup of EFL action, including a look ahead to Leeds hosting Wayne Rooney's Plymouth. And we'll finish with Laura, who will talk us through Yeovil's continued good form. I'm your host, Alex Murphy. And once again, I'm joined by Tom Gallagher, Tom Lawrence. So, boys, we want to start with Man United. Erik ten Hag's left United after a 2-1 defeat at West Ham. That left United in 14th in the Premier League, alongside 21st in the Europa League. Laura, many would say long overdue, but Erik ten Hag finally put out his misery.
Yeah, I mean, I've been saying that on this podcast for the last year and a half. I'm surprised it took a loss at West Ham. It almost feels like if he did lose that one to Villa just before the international break where he got the draw, they'd have done it then. And it just, for me, just makes a mockery out of the whole decision process. But maybe they've just been vetting and getting things ready for the new manager in the background and just then waiting for the next loss for the best time to put it out to the media. I don't know. But yeah, they're obviously definitely the right decision. I don't think anyone will have any arguments with that. He wasn't the right man for the job. He just wasn't good enough, I don't think. I don't think he was competent to be Manchester United manager in the context of we want to be back, or you want to be back challenging for major honours, Premier Leagues and Champions Leagues, rather than second tier honours. So obviously a good decision, and I'm sure everyone is happy.
And Tomo, it seems like Ten Hag was almost not surprised by it, because he probably knew that something was coming, but I know that he'd done his like pre-match press conference ahead of Leicester straight after the West Ham game, because he could do that early on the Sunday. So he was obviously defiant, and he kept talking about trust the process, and he think he could turn it around. So do you think for him, he would have been kind of almost shocked that he got that meeting in on Monday to go to Carrington and get told the news?
No. Next question. Absolutely. This has been coming, like Laura's been saying. I think I read an article from The Athletic, and one of the little bit of lines in there was that Dan Ashworth and Omar Berardo and that these guys, Wilcox, have kind of taken a little bit of a back step in terms of their in terms of being in and around Erik ten Hag over the last few weeks. So I feel like Ten Hag probably would have seen this coming, and actually I'm sure he's relieved, and he's absolutely buzzing. He's just got an £18 million payoff, and he doesn't have to manage this juggernaut of a football club anymore, and he doesn't have to get slated every single week. I'm pretty sure he's secretly quite happy about it.
Do you think, slightly worrying from a, you know, Ineos was seen as this kind of silver bullet, come in, replace the Glazers, or kind of take over football in operations from the Glazers, and they'd start running the show properly, and we were getting proper people in Berardo, Wilcox, Brailsford, people like that in the sort of leadership team, that it's felt a bit like, oh, it hinges on the next result. Like Lauro said, oh, it took the West Ham defeat. If we'd have lost to Villa before the last international break, the signs were clearly there in the summer, but he won an FA Cup in a game which, you know, Guardiola's come out and said in the last 24 hours that Man City were hungover for. So do you think there's slightly worrying signs, Tomo, that there's a bit of indecisiveness there?
Yeah, I would say Ineos, this is the first sort of big speed bump, if you can call it that, that they've hit, snagging the road, and they probably failed in this sense, that they should have got rid of him after the FA Cup win. We can all sit here in football fan as football fans, and obviously as United fans, and say, well, we got caught up in the emotion of winning that game, especially because it was against Man City, and what that meant in terms of the last season was a real struggle as a Man United fan, and to end it on that high, like, we were all caught up in the emotion of that. And I felt like, okay, yeah, Ten Hag, give him another chance. Whereas these guys are billionaires and football executives and high performance people in their fields for a reason. They should be able to take emotion out of the situation. And so, yeah, they definitely should have done it in the summer. So it does reflect bad on them. But at least they've done it now. Do you know what I mean? Like, no matter what time they did it over the course of this season, they would have got slated for not doing it in the summer. So at least they've done it now. And I kind of liken Man United. Do you remember a couple of years ago, that massive like cruise ship that got stuck in the Suez Canal? Like, that's what that, and it got stuck there for ages because it's so hard to turn it around, basically. And Man United are like a massive cruise ship or a massive ship liner that it will just take a long time to turn around into the right direction. And even when you've got the likes of Omar Berada and Dan Ashworth and all these high performance people in the right positions, it still takes time to turn everything around. And hopefully, with Ruben Amorim, they found the man who can help turn it round quicker. But one note of caution is every single positive thing that has come out about Ruben Amorim over the last 48 hours or however long it's been since Ten Hag's been sacked, all of these positive points that people are making about him, they were saying exactly the same thing about Ten Hag. And actually, I posted a graphic on Football Tweet that compared Sporting's last season with Ajax's last season under Ten Hag before we got the United job, and it's eerily similar, and both managers are eerily similar. So I wonder if Ruben Amorim will just get chewed up and spat out like many managers have tried since Fergie left.
I think the Portuguese to Premier League connection is one that works a lot better than the Dutch to Premier League, particularly for managers. You can look at Jose Mourinho being the obvious one. Nuno Espirito Santo, obviously done a really good job in England for Wolves and now Forest. There's a few examples. I've never thought that Dutch one works very well with managers. It does seem to with players, but not with gaffers. And it was actually a year ago today that me and you, Tomo, went up to watch Man United Newcastle at Old Trafford in the League Cup. And two things about that night. I remember walking in thinking, all this narrative about the stadium falling down and stuff, don't worry about that. That place has got an absolute prestige about it. It's the first time I'd ever gone. Unbelievable place to go and watch football. Must be an unreal place to play. You talk about a cruise ship being hard to turn around. If they get a few basics right, then I actually think things can happen a lot quicker because it's the sort of club that people will jump for, even if they're not quite at the heights because they've got the history. But that night, they lost 3-0 to Newcastle, a second-string Newcastle who were playing like Anthony Gordon centre-forward. I think Ryan Fraser or Matt Ritchie was playing. And they got absolutely battered off the park. And Ten Hag was stood on the sideline, didn't say a word all game, with half his face hidden in that raincoat. And we all said that night, he's got to be done. So for a year, for me, it's been blind faith, which is something that I think we can give a free pass to this kind of the new regime at the moment because they've kind of been in an interim stage, but now they're fully at the wheel, and this is the first appointment managerially for your Ashworths, etc. They need to get it right, and they are people with a background of getting things right in terms of appointment and recruitment. So I think that's a real positive, mixed in with the fact that, like I said, I think that Portuguese connection is one that's quite often successful in the Premier League. And let's be honest, you're 14th in the league. It can't get any worse, so it's actually quite a nice ticket to come into for what's his name? Amorim.
Yeah, Amorim. Yeah. So I've just spoke there about the similarities between Ten Hag and Amorim, in terms of their last season stats, and obviously coming from Portugal, coming from Holland, doing very well in those. Don't want to be disrespectful, but obviously smaller leagues than the Premier League. But one of the biggest criticisms of Ten Hag over the last 18 months to 2 years since he's been struggling is has been his sort of lack of charisma. And his lack of ability to sort of bring players with him, like, because no one's questioning in his sort of tactical acumen. He's obviously very good in that department. But what's the key difference, I think, between this Ruben Amorim and Ten Hag seems to be the charisma. And if you listen to Ruben Amorim, his English is very good, which as someone who only speaks English, I don't want to slate Eric Ten Hag's English because sometimes it's better than mine. But his English over the last 3 years has been pretty sticky. And you can see how the communication between him and the players and him and the press sometimes gets a little bit muddled up. And I don't know whether that's a translation thing or whether he's just lacking in charisma or he's... Do you know what I mean? So sometimes there is a sort of a communication breakdown, especially with Ten Hag, whereas I'm hoping with Amorim, it doesn't work that way. And when you come to manage a club like Man United, the motivational side and the charisma side, and that's almost as important, like the man management side, it's almost as important, if not more important, than like the tactical stuff. So I'm hoping that he has that in abundance, because it's clear that Ten Hag sort of failed in that department.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Like, even the managers that have struggled with English in the past, they at least have a little, some, you know, their body language, or they've got some eccentricity about them, a bit of panache Bielsa. They add to everything. Bielsa, yeah. Is a good example. It's even just his demeanour. Even if he spoke perfect English, he was just like that, with his zip over his mouth every single game. He went behind in every single game. All the players seemed to be 10% worse than they were before. And like I always said, that I thought De Zerbi would be a really good choice for that exact reason. You knew he'd come in and sort of light a firecracker under things and add that kind of charisma that you're crying out for. And I don't know a lot about the guy coming from Sporting, to be honest. So I'll judge him after I've seen him over here. But that is definitely something that you should be hoping for, because you're right. It's not just the sort of tactical prowess. It's being that figurehead of such a massive establishment like Man United. And you can't be a shrinking violet. You need to be a big, authoritative and sort of lively figure. And maybe he'll be that.
Well, it's kind of, you know, from a communication standpoint and a charisma standpoint, he wasn't up to it. I think another big challenge of Ten Hag's, and Laura, I don't know whether this was in a WhatsApp group or whether we spoke about this on the pod before, but it was this whole point of, like, if you're a manager or a head coach, you don't just sign players and then it's like, we've signed this player and he makes us this much better. It's like, you've actually got to improve these players as well. And one thing I don't think we saw under Ten Hag at all was players improving. Yes, he bled in a bit of youth, so you could say that just as they got a little bit older, Garnacho and Kobbie Mainoo and Rasmus Højlund have got a little bit better. But I think it's the other signings that he's made. To me, he didn't have anyone who he's brought on and made that 10-15% better, like you saw the likes of Klopp or Pep or Emery do. And so tactically and in regards to squad improvement, he maybe wasn't up to it either.
No, I always use Bielsa as an example there. Like, when he came into Leeds, you look at Calvin Phillips, Stuart Dallas, Luke Hale and Patrick Bamford, all fairly average Championship players that all ended up going on to be top half Premier League players playing internationally. And although these days you're not really a manager so much as you are a head coach, and like that or not, I think there's two sides to the argument, you do still have to be a good coach. And if you're not, your team need to be good coaches. So if Harry Redknapp or Sir Alex Ferguson weren't the best coach, they always had a Carlos Queiroz or someone that was. And you do need to get that progression out of your players and turn rough diamonds into good players, or make the good players even better. And again, another department that he failed in. I actually, other than getting two pieces of silverware, which you can't argue with, I actually can't see an awful lot to suggest that Erik ten Hag would be full of offers in English football ever again, to be honest with you. I think we'll see him slope off back to the Dutch league or something.
The big thing I think that Ten Hag failed to do was basically convince his players that their plan for the weekend was the right one. It was quite clear that they were going into games and, like, a couple of the players just weren't sold on it. And the Premier League is such a high level now that it only takes a couple of the players to go, well, this ain't going to win us the game. And then they're out of position, or they lack a little bit of effort in one or two different situations. And then all of a sudden, you've got four or five players running at a back three, and the midfield has completely disappeared. And that's the challenge, I guess, for Ruben Amorim, is to get these bunch of highly paid, absolute, God, for lack of a better word, arseholes of players to believe in his system and to believe in the plan for the weekend, and then to all of them to basically put 110% in every single time. Because it's quite clear, like, we've become a team that, like, teams and clubs want to play against. And, like, every single, like, especially even at Old Trafford, there's no fear factor. There was a clip that went viral last year, and it was of Morgan Gibbs-White at Forest. And I think he was the captain. It was before the game. They were in the huddle. And he, like, you could see him mouth the words, "These lot don't want to be here." And then obviously Forest go on to win the game, I think, I don't know what it was, 2-1 or 2-0 or whatever. And it's clear that quite more often than not, Man United, they're getting outworked, they're getting outjumped, they're getting out-tackled. All of the sort of the basics that that all successful teams do really well, Man United just aren't doing. They've been, over the last 18 months, relying on little bits of individual brilliance to get them through games or to get them out of trouble. And obviously, that's no sort of tactical strategy to go and challenge for the biggest prizes like the Premier League and like the Champions League. The individual brilliance has helped United win the League Cup and the FA Cup, but that can help you win the FA Cup. Look, it can help you win in those cup competitions, but over the course of a season, you get found out, and that's what happened with Ten Hag. So I'm happy that he's gone. I'm excited as a United fan to see what like the future holds with Amorim, but there is a note of caution there in the sense of United seems like this massive juggernaut of a club that just swallows players up, swallows managers up. And I'm just hoping that Amorim comes in. He's got the personality and the sort of balls to take it by the horns and take us forward.
I think that's the single biggest thing that needs turning to Man U, is that perception. You don't have that respect from anyone in the Premier League anymore. Like teams like Man City, they've got 15, 20 points on the board before they even go out because teams think they're beat already because they've got that respect to like a real high level. Like if you think about last weekend, they only beat Southampton 1-0. If Southampton had hindsight and thought, hang on a minute, we're only going to lose 1-0. We might actually have a chance in this game, but you already beat before you go out. You know you're going to lose. And Man United just don't have it anymore. So now when they're turning up at Wolves and West Ham and Forest, they're just as hard as going to Arsenal and Liverpool because everyone thinks they can get at them. And that does start with the hierarchy, which has now been changed. And it's hopefully positive signs. And then obviously the manager. So I agree with Tom. I think that goes hand in hand. And if that big personality can come in, the early days are going to be vital. It can't get much worse. You can't. Surely he's not going to sink any lower than 14th in the table, get a few wins under his belt, and all of a sudden the players will start buying in, the fans will start buying in, Old Trafford will be a fortress again, and Man United becomes a game that no one wants to play. That's what they need to get back to. And I do think it can happen sooner rather than later, as long as everyone buys in, and it's the manager's job to make that happen.
So let's look forward then, and Tomo, so since Fergie, we've gone for the hand-picked Fergie replacement chosen by the man himself. We've had the kind of old-school disciplinarian in Louis van Gaal. We've had Jose Mourinho, proven winner, Premier League legend. We've had ex-club legend Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. We've had interim consultant Ralph Rangnick. We've now had sort of successful, progressive Erik ten Hag from the Dutch league. None have really worked, albeit we've picked up some trophies. So why have Ineos gone for Ruben Amorim? And why do they think he's the man to break that cycle of rinse and repeat of bring a manager in 2 years, get rid of him?
Well, he's been massively successful at Sporting. He's been there for four seasons. They've won two league titles, I think three domestic cups. They've got a win percentage of 70%. And they play really exciting, dominant football, very attacking, and he's very wedded to this 3-4-3 formation. I wonder if it will work in the Premier League or whether he can convince the United players to do it. But not only that, he seems to have this kind of Portuguese. I know the easy comparison is the Jose Mourinho one, but you listen to a couple of these Portuguese football experts, because I'm not going to pretend to be one. And they say he is the new special one. He's not the special one. He's the perfect one. That's what they describe him as. And so it feels like he's got that charisma and that personality. But what I will say is it's easy to have that charisma and personality when you're in the Portuguese league and you're winning 90% of your games. Now, I don't want to denigrate the Portuguese league, but you've got obviously Porto, Benfica, Sporting, the three big clubs. When he come in, I think Sporting hadn't won the league for a long time. So in a similar respect, I guess, United is a similar challenge, obviously on a much bigger scale. And you can take any coach you want in these leagues who have been successful, and you can say, well, he's been successful in this league. So like you can give him the best possible chance of being a success at Manchester United. But United's a completely different club, it's on a completely different scale. United and Real Madrid are two biggest clubs in the world for me. And Every single United loss is picked through with a fine-tooth comb. Every single comment or word or anything is picked through like a fine-tooth comb from the media. And so he needs to be charismatic. He needs to have a massive personality and he needs to take it all on his shoulders. And there are only, it seems like there's only a few people in the world who could take a job like this. The likes of Pep Guardiola, of Jurgen Klopp. These are the type of guys who can take this job. And Ruben Amorim, okay, he's not there yet, but he could, but he's only 39, by the way, which is another sort of thing to know, is that he could grow with the club. And it's just United are just taking the punt that, or an educated punt, that he is that the next sort of big character, big manager that can step up. But what, another thing that to add is that it almost doesn't really matter who is Man United manager until Pep Guardiola leaves Man City.
But United don't need to be thinking about Pep Guardiola and winning the league at the minute. We need to be thinking, how do we start competing with Villa and Tottenham and Chelsea? And that's just being honest. You know, United fans can say we're the biggest club in the world, biggest club in England. We should be challenging for the Premier League and major honours. But at the minute, we need to find a way where we can just get a couple years of consistently finishing in the top four as that fourth side. At the minute, we're behind Villa by a long way, behind Tottenham by quite a way, behind Chelsea by quite a way. You've got the three big clubs in Arsenal, Liverpool, Man City, which is where we aspire to be. But that's a period of time away, and it's almost like, is the new manager going to be afforded the time to finish fifth for a couple of years, you know, and get back into the Champions League and maybe then get through to the last 16 of the Champions League and then the quarterfinals and then maybe finish third? Because as you say, United are constantly scrutinised, but it feels to me a bit like Liverpool were pre-Klopp and a little bit like Arsenal were pre-Arteta. They just need to be left alone a bit to be not mediocre, but just baby steps, trying to get back to that fourth and fifth spot. But it feels like, you know, everyone's going to be expecting the media that they should be competing for major honours again.
No, but like, there just needs to be signs of progression. And yeah, it doesn't need to be perfect. Like Ange Postecoglou at Tottenham, like it's a different scale, obviously, because Tottenham are not Man United. But last season, they weren't getting the results they were needing towards the back end. But like, everyone is sort of on board with the idea of him because it's positive football and it's a sort of a different mentality. And football fans, although on social media, we want things now. But like, match-going football fans are smarter than we give them credit for. And they will give the manager time and they will give the players time if there's signs of progression. The thing that Ten Hag struggled with was basically the only signs of progression was winning the FA Cup and the League Cup, but they were almost like the outlier. All other signs and all other markers of progression, it was going backwards. So it's almost like if you take Mikel Arteta, for example. I know he won the FA Cup in his first season, but all of the signs that Arteta and Arsenal, that is doing a good job at Arsenal, are there, except for he hasn't won a trophy since that first FA Cup win. Do you know what I mean? So no one in their right mind will say Arteta's not doing a good job at Arsenal just because he hasn't won a couple, because he hasn't won the big one. And to your point about he needs to be left alone, well, that's just never going to happen. If he comes in, he's Manchester United manager, you'll never, ever be left alone.
No, I get that. I do think, though, to a certain degree, like Big Ange, you know, Tottenham have a little run of games where they don't win and it just starts, sort of the narrative just starts turning on him a little bit. We'll come on to Newcastle in a bit with Eddie Howe. I even think what a class is those kind of second tier, non-title challenging sides. If the clubs aren't sort of winning games, they have a little patch of it, they do start to feel that pressure as well. And that, as you say, that's only magnified at United. So, yeah, be intrigued to see what happens. And Tomo, am I right in saying that then it looks like it's not going to be an immediate kind of bring in for Ruben Amorim and he's going to see it through to the upcoming international break in November? Is that right?
Yeah, which I personally think it must be something to do with like the financial compensation package. I actually think that's a mistake from Amorim, because it feels like Ruud van Nistelrooy, who is our interim manager now, could potentially get that new manager bounce. And then three or four games into this new manager bounce, Amorim comes in. And it's like, if I was Amorim, I'd be like, I'd want it right now because it can't get any worse than the minute Ten Hag left. And if Ruud van Nistelrooy wins the next three or four games, whatever it is until Amorim comes in, then I know, like the perception that you're not getting the, do you know what I mean? You're not getting the bounce. So that's a small detail though. I'm sure it's something to do with the financials, why he can't come in until November the 11th, I think it is. Yeah.
I'd want him in now. I'd want him in flying in today, and I want him getting in the dressing room before Chelsea. Like Van Nistelrooy's got Chelsea home, Payock home in the Europa League, and Leicester home. So he's already beaten Leicester last night, which we'll come on to. There's some winnable games there. I know Chelsea will be well up for it at Old Trafford, but you got three winnable games there. And I'd want him in straight away. I don't see the value in waiting a fortnight to come in and waiting for international break, because a club like United, two-thirds of your players are off on international duty anyway. So what's he going to do? Just have a chat with Marcus Rashford for a week?
Yeah, well, but this is what I mean. I don't think it's his decision. I think this is Sporting basically digging their heels in and saying, well, why don't you pay us a couple extra million compensation? And United had just turned around and said, no, we're not doing that. And We're happy to wait. That's basically it.
His first two away games will be Manchester City and Arsenal. Welcome to the Premier League, Ruben.
To be fair, we might get to see, have a proper look at how that back three works then, and whether it turns into a bit of a back five if he is going to play that. But yeah, I'll be intrigued to see if he brings his own sort of back three style to United, or whether it's going to start being that, like, this Ineos footballing department dictates the style of play and it goes all through the youth teams. I think they did some similar at Liverpool. And then the head coach just basically coaches that approach, or whether he's going to be left to put his own stamp on it. But it can't get worse than whatever it was that Ten Hag was playing, a sort of back four who can defend with no midfield and counter-attacking with zero press. But yeah, be intrigued to see how he does. But anyway, so we spoke there about Van Nistelrooy. And he got off to a winning start last night, beating Leicester 5-2. He's got the Chelsea home game, he's got the Europa League game, and he's got Leicester home again in the Prem before the new manager comes in. Laura, do you think for him it's just going to be a case of like trying to let the players play with a bit of freedom and take the shackles off for a couple of weeks?
Yeah, exactly that. Just give him a little bit of freedom. He can basically be like Harry, can't he? Go out there and attack the players, use your flair, express yourselves. Defenders get stuck in. He's not going to be judged on it too much, but if he can pick up a couple of wins, he can, you know, maintain his, you know, his admiration from the Man United fans, and maybe give himself a more of an opportunity to stay on as assistant. I don't know what the plan's going to be when the new manager comes in, whether he's supposed to be staying or not, but obviously someone that's highly thought of at the club, and you'd imagine that if he can get a tune out of the players the next couple of weeks, he might be someone that they think is worth sticking around for a while.
Ten Hag must be sitting there thinking, how's your luck though? Like, it was a Ten Hag appointment to bring in Ruud van Nistelrooy. And during Ten Hag's 2.5 years in charge of Man United, United didn't score 5 goals in a single game against the Premier League opposition. And Ruud van Nistelrooy's come in, your appointee, your assistant, and they've scored 5 goals against Premier League opponent in his first game.
Do you remember when, it must have been Mourinho, but when, do you remember when Ollie came in for his first game as interim? And I think he played someone like Cardiff and just absolutely walloped them 5. And it was the same thing. Everyone was like, where's this Man United been? And that kind of went on to get Ollie the job, because it was like, wow, we're playing with freedom again. We look a good side. But obviously the cracks started appearing later down the line with the lack of experience, etc. Probably a similar type thing, isn't it? But I think one thing we can conclude is that the players had pretty much stopped playing for him, or enough of them had. And now maybe we'll see a little bit more from all of them.
Yeah, definitely. There was some luck to the goals last night as well, weren't there, that Ten Hag would have loved in that sort of West Ham game. I don't know if he'd have been sacked anyway, because it sounds like the conversations were happening with Amorim anyway. But like, you know, no luck about the Casemiro goal, but it's just pretty out of character for him to pick the ball up 30 yards and put it in the stanchion. Bruno's free kick hit the wall and then went in. Garnacho's goal was offside, so in the Premier League would have definitely been ruled out. So I think Ten Hag, if he was watching the game, I don't know whether he would have put himself through it, would have been ruining the lack of luck that he had versus Van Nistelrooy's first game. But yeah, we'll see. I'm intrigued by the Chelsea game as well. We'll come on to that in a bit, but be intrigued to see what happens with it. But United through to the quarterfinals of the Carabao Cup. Laurie, comment in the WhatsApp group earlier about Man City losing 2-1 against Tottenham. And there's kind of 95 minutes on the clock of 5 minutes added time. And it cuts to Pep and he's sort of smiling on the sidelines as the referee's about to blow his full-time whistle. But bearing in mind, I think they won that trophy 4 times in a row. And Pep's always said that he liked getting that trophy to get a trophy sort of under the belt early in the season. Do you think he's kind of fallen out of love with the Carabao Cup a bit?
I think last night was a landmark, monumental moment and a big, big shake-up in the landscape of English football. I think that's the first chink in the armour that we have seen from Pep Guardiola in years. And for me, the perfect phrase is the beginning of the end. Because all the noises before, I think he said something like, we don't want to waste energy. Nah, you've always been a winner. You want to win every single game. And also, the team that he put out, I know it wasn't like all first choice, but it was still decent. And I just think that you take your foot off the gas 1%, you can get found out against decent sides. Obviously, they're paying Spurs. And although it's only one game and he's smiling at the end, leaving Haaland on the bench, does that psychologically roll into the Premier League? I already think they're weaker in the Premier League. I know they're top of the league and I know they're still really good. But I feel like they are on a very slight decline. And things like that do not help. And the other reason it's absolutely massive is every other single team in the Carabao Cup, I know it's quarterfinals now anyway, which is ridiculous considering we're only in October, but that's full strength, massive games now, aren't they? Because that is anyone's competition. And for the likes of Ange Postecoglou and Eddie Howe, it's absolutely everything. Because that will buy them another season next year, won't it? If they do go on certain runs towards the end of this year where it's 4 or 5 losses in a row and they're starting to get into the sort of back end of their second and third seasons and the pressure starts mounting. If they can have a Carabao Cup in their pocket, particularly for those two clubs that never seem to win anything, it would go a long way. So having Man City out should raise the eyebrows and the sort of tails of everybody and think, right, this is a proper competition again. So I'm glad it happened for a plethora of reasons. One, that becomes a really competitive tournament. And two, I really do think we're seeing the beginning of the end of Pep Guardiola's grasp on English football, because that is very, very unlike him to do something like that. And he premeditated it, he telegraphed it, and you almost went into that game thinking Tottenham are going to win this, and they did. And if that's a snowball effect, they're in a little bit of trouble.
Tomo, sort of 15 minutes left, Spurs 2-1 up, City are starting to take over possession, and they make their final substitution, bringing Nathan Ake off, and a young lad called Simpson Pusey comes on. For the next 15 minutes, they're putting balls into the box. The chances are falling to a young lad called Jacob Wright, another youngster called O'Reilly, this young lad who's come on for Nathan Ake. And you've got Haaland sat on the bench there. What's Pep's thinking there? You know, it's not going to burn too much energy for Haaland if he says he's trying to save the legs. He's a proven goal scorer. Would have maybe got the equaliser to take it through to a penalty shootout. So they wouldn't have even had another 30 minutes in the legs. Why would you do that?
I don't know, mate. Honestly, you're right. It feels like he's got so much credit in the bank, having won the Premier League so often. Obviously, the Champions League, the FA Cup, and the league. He won the League Cup for 4 years in a row, didn't he? Yeah. I just think they've just, like Laura says, I don't know if he's taken his eye off the ball. They just don't care anymore.
Same thing.
But there's no real reason. But you could tell. You could tell at the start of the game, like Tottenham, how important it was for Tottenham and Ange. They basically played their full strength team, and Man City didn't. But like, maybe we're overblowing it, because really, look, over the course of the last 6-7 seasons, Man City have just proven they've got the strongest squad in the Carabao Cup, and they basically play a second string team all the way up until the semi-final, and then they start taking the competition seriously. It just so happened that they come up against obviously a strong Tottenham who fancied themselves, and the context with them is they need to win a trophy, so then they played their strongest 11. They're at home as well, so it's never going to be an easy game, even if City played their first 11. And but yeah, like like you say, the question was about Haaland and why did he not bring him on? Like, that makes you think that they don't care.
Yeah, I just don't. I know they've played second string before, but I'm sure if we delve back through their Carabao Cup runs, there'd have been games they were 1-0 down or 2-1 down in, and they've brought on the big boys to save it. Now, look, it looked like what was left on the bench last night was Akanji, who apparently has got some fitness issues, and Edison, who's a goalkeeper. Bernardo Silva had already come on, but I know they've got injuries, but Haaland is just the glaring, obvious goal machine that you're 2-1 down, there's 15 minutes left. Just get him in that box while you're going to have them pinned in, and he's going to grab you the equaliser. I just thought it was a baffling move, because he can say about preserving energy, but if you're going to play your second string, it doesn't matter if you're through to the quarter final, because you'll just play him in that game. So yeah, I was a bit stunned by that.
The only thing I can think of is that Haaland's maybe nursing an injury, that he doesn't want to play two games in a week, and that they've just thought it's not worth the risk. That's the only sort of logical explanation for why he wouldn't bring him on.
Well, look, I think it's to the competition's game, City being out. Laurie just touched on it there. Tottenham United in the quarterfinals. Amorim will want to come in and make an immediate impact with a trophy. Big Ange is absolutely desperate for one, says he always wins something in his second season. Newcastle versus Brentford. Eddie Howe, desperate for a trophy. League form's not looking great. Thomas Frank would love to get through with Brentford. Liverpool, Arne Slot would love to get a trophy in his first season. You've got Arsenal, whose biggest kind of disservice they're getting under Arteta has not been able to get over the line in anything at home to Palace. So I think there's clubs who are going to start taking that very, very seriously now. And just before Christmas, you've got the quarterfinals. I think there'll be some great games there. So I'm not moaning about City being out. Just thought it was a really, really weird decision from Pep. And I thought the smiles and that were just strange moves. But moving on from the Carabao Cup, and let's look ahead to the weekend's Premier League action. So just spoke there about Newcastle, who beat Chelsea 2-0. But that was a bit of a turnaround from their league form, where they've not won in five Premier League games. They're only 1 point above Man United, who are in absolute crisis. So, Laurie, do you think Eddie Howe, with no European football as well and league form not looking great, under a little bit of pressure there?
Yeah, I feel like we have this conversation all the time about Eddie Howe. But the reason I don't think it ever really comes to anything is because fundamentally everyone knows he's a good manager. And I don't think it's the right time for Newcastle to start shaking it up. At some point, I'm sure he's going to get ousted if he doesn't win something, particularly because of the whole kind of background of the Saudis coming in and that sort of thing. But I just think he's the sort of Newcastle, the sort of club that if you lose a few games, of course, you're going to get the Twitter accounts coming out and saying, oh, it's time for Eddie to go, etc. But I think he's got more than enough credit in the bank, having managed his way through an amazing first season, a really difficult, tumultuous kind of injury hit second season. And this year, although they haven't started very well, there's small signs now, isn't there? Isaac scored kind of 2-2. And you just trust him to put a run together at some point. So, yes, I'm sure the pressure will mount. But, I mean, they've already taken points off Man City this season. Obviously, a really difficult place to go, St James's Park. And I'm sure Arsenal aren't going to fancy that off the back of a really poor couple of weeks.
Yeah, Tomo, so it is Arsenal that they take on Saturday lunchtime. And they're now 5 points behind Man City and 4 points behind Liverpool, albeit got a draw against Liverpool at the weekend. Do you think that that's a must win at St James's Park now for Arteta and Arsenal?
No, we're not quite there yet. But obviously, the more you fall behind, it's starting to get into that territory where, and it's just because of the high level that Man City have produced over the last 4 or 5 seasons, is like any loss feels really existential. And Loro speaks quite well about Man City struggles this year and whether that it feels maybe they're on a precipice of struggling a little bit, yet they're still top of the league. They're still winning every game. They're not playing very well. And that's the sign of, well, it's a scary sign for the Premier League, because if they win for the fifth time in a row, it's like all of a sudden we're the Bundesliga. But yeah, look, it is a big game for Arsenal, but every game seems like a big game. And the narrative I don't really like around Arsenal at the minute is this whole kind of like, oh, like the referees are against us, the injuries are piling up, the suspensions are piling up, oh, like we're struggling. And I actually think that this is a big season for Arteta, because they're on that, they've been on that upwards curve for what, three seasons now, and this is the year where it's like it feels like they need to go and win something. And if they don't go and win the Premier League, it feels like they definitely need to win the FA Cup or the League Cup to almost justify that he's still on that upwards trajectory, if you will, and or even put in a really good showing in the Champions League. So, yes, it's a massive season for them. And yeah, to your point, because they have struggled a little bit, they've had a couple of sendings off, which meant that they've dropped points. It, like games like Newcastle, which in the past might not seem like existential, might not seem like an absolute must win, this weekend, maybe it feels a little bit more like that.
I think it's must win. I'd be gobsmacked if they're anywhere near the title if they lose at the weekend and Man City win. I'm just trying to get the Prem table up in front of me, but I think it's already, is it 5 points they're off Man City already?
Yeah.
Like in the last couple of seasons, Arsenal have been kind of edging it normally at this stage. And I think the year before last, they were sort of 7 or 8 points clear at one stage and still didn't win it. If they're 8 points behind, and it's not just City, it's Liverpool, and it's not just the injuries. I saw some smart ass on Twitter the other day saying, oh, Arsenal's injuries aren't that bad. They've only got one more than City. Yeah, but it's not the amount, it's who. They're without suspended Saliba. Gabriel went off injured the other day. Martin Odegaard, probably one of the most influential player in the squad, has been out for a few games now. If they lose to Bournemouth, Newcastle, and obviously the draw against Liverpool would have been a perfectly fine result if they beat Bournemouth and they beat Newcastle tomorrow. But Newcastle away becomes a must win off the back of 1 point out of two.
Can I just make a quick point as well? I've just had a look at their fixtures between now and the next international break. They're away at Newcastle, then they go away to the San Siro and play Inter Milan, and then the week before the international break, they go to Stamford Bridge and play Chelsea. So you've got three really important, really tough games. And if Loro's right in his assessment that the injuries are to the important players, so obviously it makes a big difference. So you can see Arsenal not winning any of those three games, and all of a sudden it's like the pressure's on. I know he's got a lot of credit in the bank, and rightly so, but if they don't win any of those three games and they're lacking, they're sort of sitting in fourth, fifth in the Premier League, then the pressure starts to build.
I've actually been really disappointed with Arsenal this season. I went to Tamworth last Tuesday to watch Yeovil, and on the way back, listening to the Jamie O'Hara show where they had the fans phone in. I think they just played in Europe. And there's a bit of a narrative just starting to spin now that, like, it's all right when you're winning, but now that they're starting to drop some points and struggling to replace injured players, the Arsenal fans are saying they're really boring to watch as well. It's horrible football. And they miss a bit of the va-va-voom that they used to have. And some people were coming out and saying, even under, you know, Unai Emery, we still have bits of magic, some pockets of magic here and there. And that just isn't happening at the moment. So it can very quickly go the other way. And although Arteta's done a fantastic job and has gone very close in the last couple of years, he can't afford for it to unravel too much. And if they've got a really harsh run of games coming up now and they can't get their best players back quickly, they could be up against it. On the flip side of that, obviously, this is what champions are made of. If you can go and pull out 5-5 now, then fair play. But really, really important passage of the season for Arsenal that I think has to start with a win at St James's on Saturday.
It also highlights, to Laura's point, it highlights the importance of someone like Martin Odegaard, because he's so good at like knitting everything together for Arsenal and making them like this free-flowing, attacking, easy-on-the-eye football team. And when you take him out, okay, they might be winning games, but it's like boring. Mm. And it's functional, and it's like not easy on the eye. So, and I think he is on his way back. And what is interesting when someone comes back from a long-term injury is how long it takes them to sort of get fully fit and fully match sharp and like basically back to his best. Because sometimes, I mean, we're United fans. You remember when Wayne Rooney come back from a couple of his injuries? It takes him like 6 weeks just to get back. Like, just to get back to looking like a proper player again. So they'll need Martin Odegaard back, and they'll need him to hit the ground running, basically.
I'm not sure that Martin Odegaard's smoking 20 fags and visiting prostitutes like Wazzolo. So we'll give give Martin Odegaard a little bit of credit. The Arsenal narrative around kind of like the injuries and that, I agree it's a little bit annoying. Let's have it right. City are missing Kevin De Bruyne, Doku, Grealish, Rodri, Walker. Let's call out De Bruyne and Rodri there, two players who, I'm trying to think, I'm sorry if there's an obvious team here, but probably both players start for every team in the world. They've got their struggles there themselves, City. I know they've probably got a deeper squad, but you know they're 5 points clear, and they've had those injuries, and they've now got the, you know, Kyle Walker's been ill as well. So I'm not so sure about that. That's been from Arsenal. I know it's important players who are out, but they're very, very important players for City as well.
Yeah, but City play Southampton and Brentford at home every week.
Yeah, that's true. But they go to Bournemouth this weekend, and Bournemouth actually were a lot better against Arsenal, weren't they? I know there was the red card there, but Bournemouth been looking good. I know Semenyo, a player, Laura, that you've called out, but they look like they're having a great season this year, Bournemouth. So, you know, a Rodri-less City is always a worse City, and they got to go to Bournemouth and get something. And, you know, they could slip up there and Arsenal win at St. James's, and we're on the next pod talking about how Arsenal are back in business.
Why do you sound like Kevin Keegan when you ask that question? And they've got to go to Bournemouth and get something.
Yeah, they do a bit. Liverpool, though, they've got Brighton. Go on, Laurie.
I was just going to say, what a job. We don't really speak about the likes of Bournemouth, but what a job their manager's doing. You don't even think about them in like regards to relegation or anything, do you? I don't know where they are on the table, but I'm sure they're safe as houses, like in the middle somewhere. But easily probably the smallest team that's ever been in the Premier League, maybe along with Luton. And they're just established right in the middle of it. Them and Brentford, fair play.
Yeah, they're 11th, Bournemouth, above Newcastle, West Ham, United. And I think that they, I know we delve into the stats sometimes and take the mickey out of them, but I think they're the worst performing side versus what their stats look like that they should be doing, mainly down to their new forward not putting the ball in the back of the net. But I think he did score late in their last game, so... Yeah, positive signs for them. And as I say, City, I've got to go there and get something. Just a couple other fixtures to call out as well. This kind of top four race that we call it, or top five now. And, you know, don't mean that as a disrespect to Brighton and Forest, who find themselves in sixth and seventh. But you've got Tottenham versus Aston Villa, which is a massive game. And you've also got Chelsea versus United. And I'm not having United in that top four conversation, but four big sides there. And that makes up the Super Sunday this weekend. Move on to the EFL. Laurie, just want to quickly touch on Leeds. FA Cup this weekend, so no League One or League Two action to talk about, but there is Championship. Leeds, let's start with the result from last weekend. Drew 0-0 against Bristol City.
Yeah, obviously it was a big occasion at Bristol City, wasn't it, with the manager coming back after his bereavement, and it was kind of like, and rightly so, but there was kind of a lot of passionate and emotional energy around the stadium. And sometimes when you go somewhere like that on a Saturday lunchtime, you can end up coming away with nothing. So to be honest with you, I don't think it was a bad point, just a game to forget, really. 0-0, missed a few good chances. Another injury blow though. Ramazani's out now for a while, so that's him and the two centre mids. But I think we'll be putting that right against Plymouth this week, so no complaints at all.
Yeah, Wayne Rooney to Ellen Road, but I think only one result going to happen there. Just at the remainder of the top of the table, just to call out, Sunderland have kept up their winning ways. They're absolutely flying now. I think they're 5 points clear, actually, after their latest victory against Oxford. And they go to QPR the weekend, so they'll be looking for 3 points there as well.
I didn't know this about Joe Bellingham, but he plays with Job on his back instead of Bellingham. Yeah. Mm. And he's obviously, the connection, obviously, the comparisons always get made. But I think he's still only 18. And he's like already one of the best players in the Championship. So, man, like you've got the 2026 World Cup coming up. And it doesn't take too much imagination to suggest that Joe Bellingham and Jude Bellingham will be playing centre mid for England.
Cool.
Yeah, do you reckon Joe's probably got a lot to prove before we get there?
They've obviously
he'll probably end up getting a move because of his name anyway.
They've obviously got some youngsters doing bits at Sunderland, because that Chris Rigg now, who's like 17, 18, he's getting called out as being like watched by all the big Premier League sides as well, and people like cashing in on him at 17, a bit, I guess, like they've done with VFL players like Adam Wharton and things like that. So, you know, if you've got Bellingham doing that, Rigg doing that, they must be flying up in Sunderland.
Do you know what's interesting, actually, just before we move on from Sunderland, is I listen to the Guardian Football Weekly every single week, and they have a resident Sunderland fan on there, Barry Glendenning. And they asked him this week, obviously about Sunderland being top of the league, they asked him if he wanted to go up. And he said, absolutely not. And it's funny, isn't it? Because the gap now between the Championship and the Premier League is so much that he basically was like, I don't want to go up because next season is just going to be absolutely dog shit and we're just going to lose every game.
He needs to withdraw himself from football then, doesn't he?
Yeah.
That sounds like more of a psychological issue.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that from Barry. I've never known someone not want to go up, but there we go. Right, let's finish up, boys, as we always do with Yeovil. And Laura, I think I saw a stat that they were unbeaten in the league across October. And after what seemed like a couple of weeks ago, seemed to be down in the doldrums for certain fans about them not being able to score goals, it's starting to look a bit rosier now.
Yeah, flying skin. Quite similar to last year, actually. It sort of got to this stage and Cooper just changed the dynamic a little bit. Bringing in Joe Day and Michael Smith, it was last season. He's done something similar this year. He brought in Kieran McGuckin from Rotherham, who scored a few goals. He's actually already been recalled because Steve Evans wanted him on the bench at the weekend. But also James Plant from Port Vale and little Coffee Shaw that we got from Bristol Rovers. Those two have just come in and created so much more space and guile and magic to our team and just knitted those moments together where maybe we were lacking at home, being able to break down low blocks, etc. And we start to score goals again. And as soon as you put goals into our team, we're going to be a good side because we've got one of the best back four, back fives in the league. And obviously, we've got a very experienced campaigner in charge with Mark Cooper, who's won every single National League division there is. So really, really promising signs. The only problem is the kind of those influential players are on sort of short-term loans until January. So I'm hoping all the work behind the scenes at the moment is going into making sure that we can extend them, hopefully, or maybe even finding a couple of others that are at the same kind of level, because we're into the playoffs at the moment and we've only really just started getting going. And for a promoted side, that's a good omen, I think.
There must be a fine line with those loans of like where they're through to January, where you want them to do really well. But if they do too well, they suddenly get recalled and either playing for their parent club or they're like, we're going to send them to a League Two club on loan or a League One club on loan.
Yeah, I said on our Pyramid Podcast Twitter the other day, we're all silent Port Vale fans at the moment. Port Vale are top of the league in League Two flying, so they don't need to recall James Plant. So as hopefully, as long as they keep winning, they don't need their 18-year-old winger that's on loan at Yeovil. 20-year-old, yeah. However old he is. But hopefully no, that will remain the case. But
to be fair, while Yeovil are doing well, there's nothing saying that by pulling them back off loan and send them to a mid-table League Two club, it maybe doesn't give them the minutes or they're not winning games, is any better for the development than being part of a decent project, which it looks like Yeovil is at the moment. So hopefully we can keep those lads long-term and onwards and upwards for the Glovers. Right, boys, that's all we got time for. We'll be back next week where we will review all the weekend action, look ahead to more midweek action, and yeah. Cheers, boys. Pleasure as always.
Well done.
One, two.